So our first speaker to kick off this conference is Gary Horowitz, and his title is Black Holes and String Theory. And I trust you'll warm up slowly so people that come in on time will be not completely lost.
Okay. Well, I'd like to talk about black holes and string theory, not only for the intrinsic interest of black holes, but because it turns out that this line of investigation has surprisingly led to a new and more complete formulation of the entire theory that we call string theory. So let me start by telling you what I mean by black holes and string theory. At energies below the Planck scale, string theory reduces to 10 or 11 dimensional supergravity. So we'll be interested in solutions to these theories with event horizons. Now you notice that string theory guarantees that numerical relativists will have a long and prosperous future, because when they have their 3 plus 1 codes up and running well, they can go right ahead and work on their 4 plus 1, 5 plus 1. For these solutions, the fermions play essentially no role. So the first thing we're going to do is to set all the fermions to zero. And then we're essentially dealing with general relativity in higher dimensions with a certain type of matter. And the matter consists of a scalar field, phi, often called the dilaton, and a series of fields which are forms of various rank. So there's a 2-form, 3-form, 4-form, etc. These are higher rank generalizations of the familiar Maxwell field of Einstein-Maxwell theory. And in fact, these forms satisfy the familiar equations that their curl is zero and that the curl of the dual of the form is also zero. Now, the simplest black hole solutions to string theory are the vacuum solutions, when you simply set all the matter fields to zero. So we'll set all the forms to zero, the scalars to zero, and now you can simply take a product of the familiar four-dimensional Schwarzschild or Kerr metric and a six-dimensional torus, or if you'd prefer, any other six-dimensional Ricci flat space. This clearly satisfies the vacuum Einstein equation. And if this torus is small, the astrophysicists will not be able to distinguish this metric from the usual four-dimensional Schwarzschild metric. And in fact, this is the usual, well, in this sense, string theory includes all of the standard black hole solutions of general relativity. This is the familiar Kaluza-Klein idea that when the internal dimensions are very small, you just don't see any sign of them in low energy phenomena. Well, you can imagine that these internal dimensions are not that small. You can let one or more of these extra dimensions become large, and then you get objects that might be called black strings. One-dimensional extended objects surrounded by an event horizon. If you have two large internal dimensions, you get a two-dimensional extended object surrounded by an event horizon, which we might call a black membrane. And if p dimensions are large, you get something called a black p brain. However, there is an instability in these solutions, which was first pointed out by Gregory and Laflamme. We can see this even in just five dimensions. So if you take a four-dimensional black hole and take its product with a circle and do a linearized perturbation of that metric, you find exponentially growing modes whenever the radius of the circle is larger than the Schwarzschild radius of your black hole. And what this exponentially growing mode looks like is indicated here. It's not translationally invariant along the string, and so it makes the horizon, which is initially translationally invariant, have this sort of wiggly shape, and it looks very much like the black string is trying to break up into independent five-dimensional black holes. Gregory and Laplume not only made this linearized argument, they also just computed the entropy, the usual Hawking-Bekenstein entropy of the black string, and compared it with a five-dimensional black hole of the same total mass, and they found that the black hole has higher entropy than the black string precisely when this instability sets in, when the circle is larger than the Schwarzschild radius. Now, of course, all that's been shown is that there's a linearized instability, but you can ask what happens when the solution actually evolves. And if it actually evolves into separate five-dimensional black holes, this would violate cosmic censorship in five-dimensional general relativity. Ordinarily, black hole horizons are not allowed to bifurcate precisely because we assume cosmic censorship. Well, this seems to violate cosmic censorship in five-dimensional general relativity with these somewhat unusual boundary conditions, with one circle compactified. Well, not that unusual if you think of it in the Kluze-Klein context. But I want to point out that you can get a similar violation of cosmic censorship even with asymptotically flat boundary conditions. You don't need to have a direction compactified. And that's illustrated here. You can just take your black string and wrap it into a big circle in an asymptotically flat five-dimensional space. So if you'd like to start with completely regular initial conditions, imagine taking a very large torus of dust. This torus will, of course, collapse in toward the center, but we can arrange the radius to be so big that the time for it to collapse in is very large compared to the time for the torus itself just to collapse down to form a local black hole here. So you first form a local black string, a black hole across a circle, and then this instability will set in, and this will presumably break up into independent five-dimensional black holes, and this would be a violation of cosmic censorship in five dimensions. So I just wanted to bring this out because there's a large group of people that have come to the conference and are been in our program thinking about cosmic censorship. I view this as the most promising candidate for a counterexample to cosmic censorship in five-dimensional vacuum general relativity. And I don't think string theory has anything to say about this yet. In particular, there's no indication that this singularity will be resolved in string theory in any sense. So this could be a problem for string theory as well as five-dimensional general relativity. The standard way people deal with this is simply to compactify the extra dimensions and keep them small so that this instability doesn't arise. Yeah. Sure. Okay. Joe's asking, the singularity is on the horizon. Well, okay. So we don't really know because we don't have the full solution. But the question is, okay, so when this black string actually splits up into separate black holes, how bad is that singularity going to be? And we don't know. But one could imagine, yes, so the horizon somehow pinches off. At the point when it pinches off, it becomes singular. And then if it actually splits and you form nice, smooth horizons right after that, it would indeed be a singularity just on the horizon. Yes? You're going to discuss that? Did you say you're going to discuss that? Okay. for Schwarzschild cross R?
Yeah.
All right, well, Joe is saying that there's a paper by Lenny Susskind which shows that string theory does resolve the singularity. I'm actually not sure I know which paper you're thinking about, but we can talk about it later.
How can you get solutions like that? I mean, the initial data like that? I mean, shouldn't one because you couldn't have a toroidal horizon initially?
I don't think so. I mean, this seems very easy to construct, right? In five dimensions, we know that matter, you can't form this in 3+1 dimensions, right? But in 4+1 dimensions, there's certainly no problem taking just sort of an infinite cylinder of dust, having it collapse down and form a Schwarzschild or a Schwarzschild cross R black string. And that same local process should certainly be happening here. And you can make this radius so incredibly big that there's no way that this collapse. Simon?
This is actually the part that I'm confused about. Since there's an instability, once I collapse the black hole, I would have expected the collapsing dust already had this instability.
Right.
It's probably a good point for me to intervene and suggest that we come back to this interesting topic in the convection theory, so the flow of Gary's talk can continue.
Thank you. Yeah, I mentioned this precisely because I knew it would interest people in the audience. But we can certainly come back to it. Okay, so this is one class of black hole solutions in string theory, ordinary four-dimensional Schwarzschild or Kerr black holes across flat spaces. You can, of course, also construct the solutions which are just higher dimensional Schwarzschild and Kerr metrics. Rob Myers and Malcolm Perry constructed the higher dimensional Kerr metrics many years ago. You can take products of them with just lower dimensional tori or Ricci flat spaces. But more interesting solutions occur when you include these matter fields, and so that's what I want to turn to next. So before we include these forms as being non-zero matter sources, we have to say what they are. I mean, how do we interpret them physically? So that's, let me go through that now. So these forms F are the curl of some potential, which I'll call A, and now we can work by analogy. We're all familiar with the fact that an ordinary world line can be the source of a vector potential, a one form, A, because we can add to the action for A the term which is just the integral of A along the world line. And that's the familiar description of a charged particle. Similarly, a two-dimensional world sheet can be a possible source for a two-form potential, A2, because we can add a term which is the integral of A2 over this world sheet. And we think of this as a charged string. The two-dimensional world sheet is, of course, the evolution of a one-dimensional extended object, the string, and the fact that we are coupling the string to this two-form potential means the string is carrying a charge, and this is just the description of a charged string. Well, one can continue, and in general, one has the statement that a P plus one dimensional world volume is a possible source for a P plus one form potential, a P plus one. And this is then the evolution of a P dimensional extended object. And so we learn that a P plus two form F, which is just the curl of this P plus one form A, is the field produced by a P dimensional charged extended object. So that is the interpretation of these form fields, F, just higher dimensional generalizations of ordinary charged particles. But we're talking about supergravity. And supergravity doesn't have fundamental charged sources. All we have to play with are the metric and these fields. But, as we all know, black hole-like solutions, or more generally, black P-brains, can carry the charges associated with this higher rank form. And it's just the familiar story of a Reisner-Nordström black hole describing a charged black hole in a theory which is just Einstein-Maxwell. And what you need here is a little non-trivial topology. You have to make sure that there's a sphere of the right dimension which is not the boundary of some smooth surface which fills it in, so that when you integrate the dual of F, you don't automatically get zero. And that's precisely what happens in these black hole-like solutions. Well, that's what we want to construct, and it turns out, like in four-dimensional general relativity, if you impose enough symmetry, you can find the exact solution. So let me now give you essentially the general solution. This is the solution for a large class of black P brains. These all live in 10 dimensions, and P, which is the number of extended dimensions, the number of the extended object, can be anything from 0, the familiar black hole, to 6. Okay, and this is what the solution looks like. It's given here in terms of two functions of R, F of R, and H of R. F of R is just 1 plus a constant over R to some power. H is 1 minus a constant over R to some power, the same power. These two constants, R0 and R1, are related to the mass and charge of this solution. And you can see all the symmetry. It's clearly static. These y's are coordinates along the brain. So I goes from 1 to p. And you clearly have translational and rotational symmetry along the brain. In the directions perpendicular to the brain, coming out, you have the usual spherical symmetry, as we do for ordinary black hole solutions. This structure here of GTT and GRR is just familiar from the usual black hole solutions, 1 minus something over R. And the power is just what you'd get from solving Laplace's equation in a space which is 9 minus p dimensional, as you see here. If you set R1 equals 0, then F goes away, and this is exactly the product of a Schwarzschild black hole and flat space, indicated here. If we do the opposite and set R0 equal to 0, then we get the extremal limit of these black P brains. One thing to note about this extremal limit is that when R0 is 0 and H is 1, you clearly see that P equals 3 is a little bit special. And it's special because for P equals 3, this F is 1 plus a constant over R to the fourth. You take the square root of it and you get a 1 over R squared, and that multiplies this. And in that limit, these spheres approach a constant area as you go in toward R equals 0. And we're going to sort of make use of that in just a few minutes. The Penrose diagram for these solutions all look like Schwarzschild. Even though these are charged objects, there is not a non-singular Cauchy horizon or inner horizon. These solutions all have a regular event horizon at R equal to R0 and a singularity at R equal to 0 as long as you have this general structure with non-zero R0. Okay, let me keep this up. I'm going to want to refer to it a little bit later, so I'm going to put the metric over here now that I have another overhead. Thank you. Okay, so that's a large class of black P-brain solutions. Of course, you don't have to stop there. These solutions have been generalized in many ways. People have found solutions with non-zero angular momentum. These solutions don't have any angular momentum, but you can add angular momentum in these transverse directions. And in fact, in higher dimensions, angular momentum can lie in various planes. And so it's not just one number, but many numbers. You can add different components of the angular momentum. You can add or construct solutions with multiple charges. These solutions have just a single charge, but you can put them together in various ways and find solutions with charges associated with several of these different rank forms. And you can actually do that in several ways, depending on how they're oriented and stuff. You can add waves to some of these solutions, especially the extremal solutions can be generalized by adding traveling waves. And there's really a whole industry which has sprung up, just finding solutions of these field equations with horizons. And quite a lot is known. I'm not going to talk about the general solution in any sense. I'm going to actually focus on just two of these solutions, the P equals 3, so-called three-brain solution that you see here, and a solution with two charges that I'll come to in a few minutes. Well, I said super... Question? Yeah.
With the ones with angular momentum, do they have the structural current size of the rising and rising ones? Like, the ones with charges have any losses?
Yeah, the question is, do the solutions with angular momentum have a regular inner horizon and look like Kerr? Because I said that these charge metrics did not look like Reisner-Nordström. As I recall, the Kerr metrics look very much like the Schwarzschild metrics as well. They do not have regular inner horizons either. So I said that the supergravity equations that we've been focusing on so far do not have fundamental sources. But now when we move to string theory, we learn that string theory does include fundamental sources for these P-form or these higher rank forms. And these sources are called D-brains. They were discovered by Joe Polchinski and have been very useful in many ways in our investigations of string theory. These D-brains have a charge-to-mass ratio which agrees with the charge-to-mass ratio of these extreme solutions I was just talking about, these extreme black P-brains. So it's like taking Einstein-Maxwell theory, looking at sort of Reisner-Nordström black holes, but adding to your theory charged particles with Q equals M. So we have now fundamental sources with essentially the charge equal to the mass.
What considerations force that charge ratio?
Supersymmetry, I guess, is the quick answer. These sources preserve sort of half the supersymmetry, and that I think is the short answer. Yes? In a perturbative description of string theory, which is the one we understand best, these are non-perturbative objects. They're certainly not something you construct from the usual perturbative string states. What we've learned in string theory, and I think Joe might talk about this in the next talk, is that there's various dualities which change how we think about string theory. And in some of these different limits, some of these D-brains do become fundamental. And what we used to think of as perturbative string states actually become non-perturbative objects. But in the sort of standard or the sort of most familiar view, these are really non-perturbative and not made up of ordinary strings.
And these are all stationary solutions.
Yes, these metrics are certainly all static. The D-brains, you can imagine time-dependent solutions, though. There is certainly no problem. We believe these D-brains are simply, they are extended objects. They have a tension. If you wrap one up into a sphere, it will just collapse under its own tension. And we have equations for the dynamics of these objects. Well, if we now introduce a quantity which I'll call the string coupling, which is something governing the strength of interactions between strings. G, another quantity, LS, which is a string length. That's a fundamental scale set by the string tension, a new length scale in string theory. And then we just let N be the number of D-brains we have. So let's pick a certain type. Let's say we're working with P-brains of a definite P. We take N of them, put them parallel and right on top of each other. Then the gravitational field produced by those sources is indeed given by this metric, where, well, this is an extremal solution. I said the charge to mass ratio was the same, so R0 would be 0. And this other parameter, R1, is given by this formula here. So the constant which appears in the metric, this R1 to the 7 minus t power, is simply the string coupling times the number of d-brains times this length scale. And so what you see is that in the presence of these sources, you have a gravitational field, as you'd expect, but as the string coupling goes to zero, this metric becomes flat. R1 simply goes to zero, and then, of course, F is 1, H is 1, and your space is simply ordinary flat space. So... Well, no, it's actually everywhere. The question is the statement I just made valid only asymptotically at large distances from the brain, or is it also valid sort of nearby? And I would say it's also valid nearby for any sort of R not equal to zero. And what's essentially happening here is that Newton's constant, which we think of as giving sort of the strength of gravity, if you have a given mass, the gravitational field is G times M, where G is Newton's constant. That Newton's constant is not a sort of fundamental parameter in string theory, but it's actually determined in terms of this string coupling and this string length. And when I take G to zero, this string coupling to zero, I'm actually turning off Newton's constant. So I'm turning off the back reaction and saying I can have mass, but it sort of stops gravitating because I've turned off that gravitational coupling. And that's why space-time is becoming flat.
If you look at this as a solution of this d-brains, where are the d-brains? Where is the location of the d-brains in the matrix?
Okay, so Abe's asking, where are the d-brains? All right. In this case, if I take... we're now assuming that this is not G is not zero, right? So I have a non-zero R1. The metric is this with H equal to 1 because it's extremal. F is not 1. And I would say the d-brains in this picture are at R equals 0. That's the sort of source, if you'd like, of the field. Question? Right. Okay, so the question is, are these d-brains really on top of each other, or are they just parallel and maybe separated a bit? And the claim is, in order for the gravitational field to be given by this metric, they have to be really right on top of each other. And in fact, there's another solution in which you separate them. And you can show that this whole family of field equations you have in supergravity, four metrics of this form, and I haven't given you what the matter fields are, but there's a certain form for the matter fields as well. If you make that ansatz, everything is determined in terms of this one function f, which satisfies Laplace's equation in this transverse space. So I've just written down the simplest solution of Laplace's equation in this transverse space, the one which has sort of a, looks like a point source. But there are other solutions in which you have sources spread out all over, and you can take a sum of such solutions. So there is a solution with the d-brain spread out. And it's just a sum of terms like this with, you know, at different locations in space. So this is the one where they actually really are right on top of each other. Okay. But now because we can take this limit when this basically turn off gravity and you have just flat space, you can look at the dynamics of these sources sort of by themselves. And what was found was that if you add a little bit of energy to these d-brains, the low energy excitations of n d-brains, n parallel d-brains at the same place, is described by a supersymmetric SUN gauge theory. That's just found by using sort of rules about string theory in flat space. And so these excitations of the d-brain is just an ordinary Yang-Mills theory, a supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. So now we can do the following thing. Let's take a brain. In this case, I'll take the 3-brain and add a little bit of energy to it. And actually, it turns out to be a little more convenient rather than adding a little bit of energy to imagine putting it at a finite temperature. It doesn't really matter, but I'll say it a little more clearly with the temperature. So when Gn is much less than 1 and you're basically in this flat space regime, we have the excitations of the d-brain is described by this supersymmetric gauge theory, and I can count the number of states of this 3 plus 1 dimensional Yang-Mills theory at a given temperature T. When this coupling is bigger than 1, then I have a black P-brain solution here. I can look at the, I can take that black P-brain solution at the same temperature T and compute the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of this black P-brain, and I can compare the entropy in these two regimes, and what you find is that the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is 3/4 of this Yang-Mills entropy computed from the fundamental excitations of the D-brains. Okay, so first of all, this tells us that the D-brains, the gauge theory, certainly has enough degrees of freedom to account for the entropy of the black hole. In fact, it seems to have a little bit too much. The fact that these are not exactly equal is not a surprise. And you can see that in two ways. From the gauge theory side, we are counting states, first of all, at weak coupling. But to compare with the black hole, we have to extrapolate to strong coupling. And there's no reason why the energies can't change a little bit when you go to strong coupling. The density of states can change, and the entropy can shift for a given energy. From the black hole side, if we start with this metric and try to decrease the coupling, that means making R1 smaller and smaller, the curvature gets bigger. And when the curvature reaches this sort of string scale set by that fundamental string length, string theory predicts modifications to this metric. And the metric will change. There could be areas can change. And so we don't expect these two numbers to agree exactly. However, the fact that they're related by such a simple 3/4 suggests that there is some simple relation between these two descriptions, which has not yet been found. And so this remains a little mysterious, why the relation turns out to be so simple. There are other cases where the entropy does agree exactly. And so let me turn to those next. For those cases, you have to consider solutions with more than one charge. And so I'm now going to turn to the solution with a charge associated with a five-dimensional extended object and one brain. You can sort of see why this is a natural thing to do. If P is 5, then F is 1 plus a constant over R squared. When you add two solutions, you sort of have a metric like this with products of functions. And if you have two factors of 1 over R squared, in front here, you take the square root, you get a 1 over R squared. You can cancel the R squared here. So in some very vague sense, that looks like it might be as good as a three-brain metric. Don't worry about that. I know that wasn't very clear. Okay, but let's just take this solution. One can write out the solution and do the following. We're going to assume four of our space-time dimensions are very small, wrapped up into a very small torus. And we're going to take the five-brain, which has five extended dimensions, and wrap four of them around the torus. So this now looks like a one-dimensional extended object living in a six-dimensional remaining space. You then take one-dimensional extended objects, these one-brains, and add them to these five brains which are wrapped up. So I show you here Q5, five brains, all wrapped around some torus in this vertical direction, and the one brain's going along like that. Now, if you again go to weak coupling, the space-time describing these D-brains becomes flat. You find again a sort of gauge theory-like description. This is a field theory, and since you have only one effective extended dimension here, this is a 1 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theory. It's a field theory which has extra conformal invariance in 1 plus 1 dimension. And one can again count states in that theory. If the coupling is large, you notice the relevant parameter here is like what we had before. Before it was the string coupling times the number of D-brains. Here it's the string coupling times the number of D-brains, but since you have two types of D-brains, you have to do it twice, and so you get G squared, Q1, Q5. When this effective coupling is large, you have, again, a black hole-like solution. However, this is now a black string in six dimensions. You can add energy, the same amount of energy, to both of these in both of these descriptions, and you can count the entropy, and you find in this case the black hole entropy agrees exactly with the entropy you compute in the field theory, this conformal field theory. Now, after everything I just said about why it wasn't too surprising that the entropies didn't agree in the other case, you might ask, why do they agree in this case? So, why does this work? Well, in one special case, we can give a simple answer. And the special case is, if you add the energy sort of only in modes moving in one direction along this string. So that requires that your total momentum in that direction is actually equal to the energy. These are massless fields, and so you require that the total momentum is equal to the energy you've added. So you're exciting only, say, right-moving modes. Then it turns out there remains unbroken symmetry in this unbroken supersymmetry in this solution. The black string actually remains extremal. This extra momentum is like another charge, and the minimum energy for the Q1 and Q5 charges plus this momentum charge is just the solution you have with P equal to E. So the black string remains extremal. And in this case, where you have unbroken supersymmetry, you can count special states, whether it's states with these charges are called BPS states, and we know a lot about them. Their properties don't depend on the string coupling. And so we expect in the supersymmetric case that you can count states at weak coupling, extrapolate to strong coupling, and nothing will change. And it certainly works in that case. But you don't have to excite only the right moving modes. You can actually add energy in both left and right moving modes. In other words, consider the case where the total momentum along the string is just zero. The entropy still agrees. It's been shown that you can add angular momentum to the system and consider rotating black strings, and the entropy still agrees. The spectrum of Hawking radiation from these near-extremal solutions also agrees with what you calculate at weak coupling and what, you know, Hawking essentially calculated at strong coupling. So this is working extremely well and far better than one would expect just from supersymmetry arguments. And so the question remains, why is this working? Well, I think a key insight was to focus on the near horizon geometry of these extreme black holes. So let me remind you or illustrate this with a familiar example. And let's just look at the ordinary four-dimensional Reissner-Nordström solution. Let's take its extremal limit. And then, as you know, the geometry on a static surface looks like this. It's asymptotically flat. But as you come toward the horizon, there's this long, in fact, infinite throat where the horizon is infinitely far away along this static surface. If you go down the throat and ask what does the solution look like far down this throat, well, clearly the area of the spheres, these two spheres, is approaching a constant, and the geometry actually becomes a product of this two-sphere, constant two-sphere geometry cross a geometry involving this sort of radius direction and time, which turns out to be just two-dimensional anti-de Sitter space, the space of constant negative curvature with Lorentz signature in two dimensions. Well, this metric is clearly simpler than the full extreme Reissner-Nordström solution. It is a non-singular metric. It has enhanced symmetry. Both metrics have the rotational symmetry associated with the two-sphere, but the time translation symmetry of Reissner-Nordström is now enhanced to the full symmetry of ADS2, and that's an SL2R symmetry group. This is well known and called the Robertson-Bertotti metric, well known as the solution of Einstein-Maxwell. Well, just as an aside, let me point out that you can do exactly the same thing for extreme Kerr, something that Jim Bardeen and I looked at in this program. Extreme Kerr also has the property that the horizon is infinitely far away along a space-like surface. You can go down the throat and look at what the limiting geometry looks like. And it is, in some sense, a vacuum analog of this Robertson-Bertotti metric. You again have a complete non-singular vacuum solution now with enhanced symmetry. The time translational killing field of Kerr is extended, if you'd like, to a full SL2R symmetry group of this near horizon geometry. Along the axis, the two-dimensional geometry along the axis is exactly ADS2. So there are many, many interesting similarities. But what we're interested in now is the higher dimensional generalizations of this. What happens if you do this near the, say, for the three brain? So in this case, we have the metric. We're in the extremal limit, so H is just 1. We can forget that. We're now looking at the limit when R is very small. And I already pointed out that when R is very small and P is 3, these spheres, which are now 5 spheres, 8 minus 3, 5 spheres, become constant as R goes to 0. And the rest of this metric just becomes, well, when R is very small, the 1 is negligible, and this metric turns out to be just 5-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. So this near horizon limit of the extreme 3 brain is the product of 5-dimensional anti-de Sitter space across a 5 sphere. And if you look at the solution with 2 charges that I was mentioning before, the 1 brain and 5 brain system, that has a near horizon limit, which turns out to be the product of ADS3 cross S3 cross a 4 torus. And let me just point out that if you look at perturbations of these sort of throat geometries, these near horizon geometries, sort of just before you've completely decoupled the asymptotically flat region, so you go down to sort of small r but not exactly, take the limit as r goes to 0, and you ask what is the energy of these perturbations as seen from the asymptotically flat region, you find that the energy goes to 0 as seen from the asymptotically flat region, and that can be interpreted just as an infinite redshift. You're basically going so far down the throat, so close to the horizon, that any finite energy excitation in these metrics really is seen, or is not seen. It becomes a zero. It's just its energy is zero in the asymptotically flat limit. Okay. So we've looked at the near horizon geometry, but we still have to ask, how does this explain that remarkable agreement we were finding between these weak coupling and strong coupling limit? Well, if we look at these solutions, which are close to extremality, and take the near horizon limit, what you find is not just a product of ADS and the sphere, but a product of a black hole in ADS cross a sphere. So that's the near horizon limit of these black holes, which are sort of, or black P brains, which are close to extremality. In the case of the three brain, where we were off by that factor of 3/4, if you take this black three brain geometry, you take the near horizon limit, so you basically have a black hole in ADS5, and you try to lower the coupling, you run into the usual problems that the curvature becomes very large in string units, the metric gets modified, the area of the horizon gets corrected, and so one expects some sort of change, and one just can't calculate that exactly when the curvature gets really, really big. However, in the case of the one-brain, five-brain system, something very nice happens. Then we're basically talking about black holes in ADS3. Now, there is only one central, one black hole in ADS3, the so-called BTZ black hole, by Banados, Teitelbaum, and Zanelli, which was discovered, early 1990s, I guess. And that black hole locally has constant curvature. In fact, it is just ADS with identifications. And in that case, when you start taking this limit as the coupling gets smaller, the curvature gets big. But since this is a space of constant curvature, one can argue that the string, that there should essentially be no string corrections as this geometry, as you take the weak coupling limit. There is, of course, another argument for this, which is a sort of field theory argument, We said that at weak coupling, you have this 1 plus 1 dimensional field theory, which has conformal invariance, so it's a conformal field theory. And using properties of conformal field theory, you can also argue that the number of states, well, it's essentially determined by something called the central charge, and the central charge can be computed exactly for all values of the coupling. It's constant. It's independent of the coupling. And so from the field theory, there's an argument why this shouldn't change when you increase the coupling. But from the geometry side, the reason that it doesn't change is because of special properties of the BTZ black hole. And as far as I know, all cases where the entropy has been computed exactly in string theory reduce in the near horizon limit to this BTZ black hole. Well, we can take this all one step farther. We've been talking about black hole solutions and their weak coupled limits. If we take the, I mentioned that the excitations in this near horizon geometry all have zero energy as seen from the original asymptotically flat region. If you now sort of demand the same thing at weak coupling, at weak coupling, you take a low energy limit, which basically sets the energy in this flat space-time to zero. That turns off all the excitations sort of in the bulk, in the flat space-time surrounding your D-brains. And when you do that, you essentially decouple the SUN gauge theory describing the excitations on the D-brains from the sort of usual closed string states, which are describing excitations far from the brain. So the same low energy limit, which at strong coupling sort of was leading to this low this near horizon geometry, at weak coupling decouples the gauge theory from the bulk. And now one has the following really remarkable situation. We're describing one situation, which is a sector of string theory with a certain charge in a certain limit, which is low energies. And now we have a description in terms of this gauge theory, which we initially thought was valid only at weak coupling. But the gauge theory, of course, is valid at any coupling. We can certainly consider the gauge theory at high coupling. And yet at strong coupling, we had this completely separate description of the physics in terms of these near horizon geometries and Juan Moldacena put two and two together and came up with this remarkable conjecture, which is that in the case of a three-brain, there was actually several conjectures for each of these various situations, but for the case of the three-brain, to start with, we had 3 plus 1 dimensional world volumes, and so you end up with a four-dimensional SUN gauge theory should describe all of 10-dimensional string theory. Well, you might think on ADS5 cross S5, this near horizon geometry, but you can add finite energy excitations above this, and so you actually are led to the belief or the conjecture that the gauge theory describes string theory on arbitrary spacetimes which simply approach ADS5 cross S5 at infinity. This conjecture has been around for about a year and a half now. At first, I think most people thought it was crazy and would fall apart within months, but it hasn't. It's held up remarkably well to a variety of tests. I think both Joe and Rob Myers later in this conference are going to be talking more about this conjecture and telling you various properties or tests of it. This gives us a more complete formulation of string theory. We can adopt this as the definition of string theory, if you want, with boundary conditions that your metric approach ADS5 cross S5 at infinity. The definition is string theory is simply gauge theory. It's a bit disappointing, but we take what we get. Just to say, I have a little bit more time. Let me just say a few words about this. The description is, in a sense, holographic, and this goes back to earlier ideas on that quantum gravity should be holographic, that was discussed by Tehuft and Susskind many years ago. But the sense in which it's holographic is that the conformal boundary for anti-de Sitter space is this time-like tube. And so if you have a space-time which is asymptotically anti-de Sitter, its conformal completion will look like this. The gauge theory, remember this is ADS5, the gauge theory is one lower dimension, and one can think of it, in some respects, as living on this boundary at infinity. And so the idea is that you have a theory living on the boundary of a space, and from it you can reconstruct all physics taking place in the bulk, in the interior. As far as I'm concerned, the main consequence of this conjecture, now just taking it at face value, accepting it as true, the main consequence is that we learn is has to do with evaporation of black holes. We can certainly imagine forming black holes in anti-de Sitter space. If the black holes are small, and by that I mean their Schwarzschild radius is smaller than the radius of curvature of the ADS space, they should behave more or less like Schwarzschild black holes in flat space, and they should evaporate. So we could imagine forming small black holes in ADS, letting them evaporate, and we would get a Penrose diagram which looks something like what's shown here. It looks like the usual evaporating black hole diagram, except that infinity is now a time-like surface, not a null surface. And the conjecture says that this entire process, from the initial star through the formation of the black hole through its subsequent evaporation, is described in the gauge theory by unitary evolution of some initial state. You pick your initial state, the gauge theory simply evolves it unitarily, arbitrarily far into the future, and that is going to be, if you believe the conjecture, the description of black hole formation and evaporation. Well, I guess I have a minute to give you one minor consequence question. Okay, so just to repeat your comment, so the idea was that just because we have unitary evolution in the gauge theory doesn't necessarily imply from the sort of standard space-time picture that the evaporation of the black hole will result in some pure state, because the state of the gauge theory at late time here might depend on interior observables or things sort of in some non-local thing dating all the way back to this horizon, if I understood your comment. I mean, Daniel is saying that we don't really know that the state here depends only on some sort of data on this sort of gravity side on some space-like surface up here. And I guess I would say that you're right. It has not been shown that in the sort of case of evaporating black holes, the gauge theory represents the state of gravity just here. It's the whole issue is tied up with what happens inside the black hole. How is the space-time inside the black hole represented in the gauge theory? That's something which is still an open question. It's a very important question. So I think most people in string theory believe that, you know, it will turn out to be the case that this, you know, evaporation does give you a pure state, and this state up here is pretty much the same as the state down here in terms of being able to sort of describe it in terms of supergravity modes on a space-like surface. But that's a belief, and it really needs to be checked with more detailed calculations of the relation between these two descriptions.
After the black hole evaporated. compression circuits in the boundary theory.
But so you're saying that why can't the state here depend on some...
since one doesn't have the correspondence mapped out, why isn't it so plausible or open possibility that what corresponds to the state of the field at some flight after the black hole was evaporated in the bulk picture corresponds to the state of the system on some non-Hershey surface in the boundary?
Non-Cauchy surface in the boundary. Oh, something which goes way back here or something. I could go through. I mean, there's been various things which have been checked. For example, if you take ADS and look at sort of just the usual supergravity fields, that all of the modes of the supergravity fields on ADS have corresponding sort of states in the gauge theory, and the correspondence there seems to sort of respect the causality. Even though you have lower dimension here, you can recover the sort of full sort of five-dimensional causal relations of fields in ADS from the sort of states you construct here. So at that level, it looks like the causality is working fine. There's been various other things which maybe we can get into in the discussion period if you want. I guess we don't know a lot, but there have been certain checks which have given us some hope that this is going to be normal. But of course, we haven't really dealt with the key issue, which is what happens when you have the horizon in the black hole, and that could change things a lot. So maybe we should just get into that. Could I have just 2 minutes to finish up? I wanted to mention one other thing very briefly. So these small black holes evaporate. Big black holes don't evaporate in ADS. It turns out that the negative cosmological constant acts like a confining box. A big black hole rapidly comes into equilibrium with its Hawking radiation and just sits there. That's a stationary state, at least according to the usual semi-classical arguments. In the gauge theory, the description of this large black hole is just some very high energy state, looking approximately thermal. If you want to take the exact sort of thermal state, you could do that for the sort of constant temperature thing. But then you can ask, what happens when you perturb the black hole? If you kick the black hole, that should correspond to sort of perturbing this sort of thermal state in the gauge theory. But we know what happens when you kick a black hole in asymptotically flat space times. When you kick a black hole, it rings. And there are quasi-normal modes which govern the sort of ringing of the black hole, and you see the mode decay. And so you can ask about quasi-normal modes of black holes in ADS. And so that's something that I recently worked out with my student, Veronica Hubany. And so you can compute these quasi-normal frequencies. And what you find is that even though there's two dimensional parameters in ADS, the sort of Schwarzschild radius and the cosmological constant of ADS, the quasi-normal frequencies for large black holes depend on only one particular combination, which turns out to be the surface gravity or the black hole temperature. And they, these frequencies, or at least the imaginary part, which is indicating the decay of this mode in ADS, turns out to, is a prediction for the approach to thermal equilibrium in the gauge theory. This is a case where one sort of, if you adopt the conjecture, you can do a supergravity calculation which tells you something about the gauge theory that you would not be able to compute independently because it's strong coupling. It's hard to do calculations of approach to thermal equilibrium. But these quasi-normal frequencies give you a prediction for what they should be. And because of properties of ADS, you don't actually have these power law tails that Richard Price told us about in the asymptotically flat case. These things just decay away. How do they depend on GN? They do in the sense that the black hole temperature depends on GN, right? It's some combination of this. All right, well, I've taken up more than my share of the time, so let me quickly conclude with just a few open questions. we'll launch into the discussion period. So one has already been brought up already. How is the space-time inside the black hole described in the gauge theory? This, I think, is a key issue that we really don't understand very well, and so we need to sort of get more insight into that. How do we describe other boundary conditions? Clearly, the world is not asymptotically ADS cross a sphere. And, you know, if you had just sort of said, okay, we want to construct a quantum theory of gravity, let's start, you know, picking some boundary conditions, there's no reason why ADS cross a sphere would be sort of physically the right or the most natural boundary conditions to pick. We were sort of forced into it by this whole chain of arguments about black holes and near horizon geometries and all of that. We want to get away from that and describe things. Maybe Joe will say a little bit about some ideas he's had about asymptotically flat boundary conditions as a limit of this. And finally, well, this is just one of the important open questions. I've talked about some cases where we can compute the entropy of these black holes exactly. These were all in the extreme or near extreme case. Although I said everything in terms of these funny black strings in six dimensions, I hope it's clear that one can sort of compactify that sixth dimension, view this as an ordinary black hole in five dimensions, and if you add another charge and make the solution a little more complicated, you can actually do this for charged black holes in four dimensions. So real four-dimensional charged black holes have entropies that can be computed exactly in string theory, but only in this extreme or near extreme limit. And we would like to have precise, exact calculations of Schwarzschild black holes. Anyway, thank you. So,
okay, please repeat the question.
All right, the question was, this picture seems to imply that we have an understanding of the correspondence even in the presence of arbitrary high curvatures, such as, you know, the one that we would encounter at that tip. And the statement is, if you believe the conjecture, the answer is yes, because this conjecture says that the gauge theory is describing the physics in the bulk in all situations which are asymptotically, you know, these boundary conditions. And there's no restriction to weak curvatures. The weak curvature assumption is a certain limit of the gauge theory. So people talk about the large end limit, okay, as one case where you sort of turn off certain things in supergravity side. But the full force of the conjecture, if you include finite end, finite coupling, everything, would be that, yes, it should describe everything. I mean, the quantum geometry that's taking place when, you know, you have Planck-scale curvatures inside here should be described by the gauge theory. That's the hope.
Right, but that's because we actually have evidence that the conjecture is that true. Could we get extra evidence from that black hole representation is unitary or
I guess I don't know. There is a solution, for example, for a sort of, you can take a null particle moving in ADS. The null particle produces a shock wave. The shock wave has a curvature singularity along the original orbit, you know, the geodesic, null geodesic. That's a solution which we have good evidence that we can describe in the gauge theory. Okay, maybe you don't want to call that. I mean, it's sort of the curvature falls off as you move away from the particle, so it's sort of singular only at the particle and moves away. I would say that we don't have sort of evidence that would convince you that we could describe it in this situation. And what's happening is people are basically doing calculations that they can do, gaining evidence that the conjecture is right and making sort of extrapolations.
To the extent that you believe you believe it. discussion of large black holes being in the
universe. My question is mostly about the growing things deletion and having
if there's a configuration, it has large curvatures in the main theory of the horizon. You can't calculate it.
Can you interpret his answer?
Rob was just pointing out that large black holes we think we can describe as these sort of approximately thermal high energy states in the gauge theory, and that seems to be quite uncontroversial. People have discussed thermodynamics and things. If you believe that, and if you believe that the gauge theory also describes the space-time inside, which many of us do, but I mentioned that exactly how that happens is one of these unsolved problems, then you have to believe that the singularity inside a large static black hole is described in the gauge theory in some way.
In the back there?
When you present the talk, string theory is almost something like a detour of the time.
Is string theory a detour to SUN?
Our view of string theory is certainly changing. We do not yet have the final formulation of the theory. And at the present moment, it does seem that, well, it's not just SUN, because I mentioned these other boundary conditions. If you had spacetimes which asymptotically went to ADS3 across a 3-sphere across a 4-torus, that would be described by this 1 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theory, and that would be the description of all of string theory on spacetimes which had those boundary conditions. So there are a few different sort of conjectures here, logically different, but you know, all sort of following from the same chain of arguments. And so that's clearly not, you know, satisfactory. You know, we don't want different field theories describing different boundary conditions. We want to put it all together in some way. So I would say at the moment, yes, those field theories look more fundamental. You could forget everything I said and just say, okay, here's the field theory, this is string theory, now we just have to find out how to translate, you know, concepts from the gauge theory or field theory into space-time language. But this is an evolving subject, and so who knows what things are going to look like in a few years from now.
Jim?
Yes. You said a little bit in that first question about inside a black hole. You know, inside black holes in usual space-time, you have cosmologies, essentially. And I'm wondering if there's any evidence that if you look inside this sort of black hole, you get something like a cosmology in higher dimensions in string theory or something like that.
Well, you can just look at the solution if you want to ask what the geometry does. And sure enough, you know, this does look like a time-dependent homogeneous cosmology. The space-time geometry inside the horizon is just a higher dimensional. I mean, you have the sort of some extra translational symmetries, but then you have the sort of spherical symmetry that we usually have and the translational symmetry, so of course the T that we usually have, and of course R becomes the time coordinate. So this is some homogeneous evolving cosmology in 10 dimensions. The thrust of your question is, if we understood the inside of black holes, then we'd have a good handle on describing cosmology. And I think you're right. And I think another sort of very important question is, how does all of this, you know, carry over to a cosmological context, but I think that's also something we have very little insight into so far.
One question, Kirsten, is from the point of view of the gauge theory, would black holes be distinguished from white holes, and if so, what would be the distinction, and is there something that would favor black holes over white holes in nature or something?
Well, that's a good question. I think a stationary state in the gauge theory would have to correspond to something like a static black hole, which has both the white hole and the...
Your picture there has a black hole.
Oh, because I'm not starting... You see, I've sort of definitely... Well...
Right, so in the gauge theory, corresponding white hole in the theory, or my question is, would there be, or would the theory only have black holes, and if so, how does that all work?
Okay, so I sort of judiciously chose to start my evolution here, but if you evolve this into the past, we know just from dynamics in ADF that dust or whatever my star is here will recollapse evolving into the past just as much as evolving into the future. So if I had chosen this to be some initially sort of time-symmetric initial surface, and my black hole evolves into a black, it evolves into a black hole here, in the past it will certainly evolve into a white hole. And I think I can't avoid that, because if I just take some any configuration of dust, so geodesics just focus in ADS, and they're going to form black holes both in the future and past.
If you only use dust, the same would be true in ordinary. You're going to make dust. I mean, so let's not use dust.
Well, but the negative cosmological constant gives you an extra attractive focusing, right? And so that will, be true both in the past and the future.
There will be white holes.
So I think there will be, right? If you, it has to do with initial conditions, though. White holes always deal with initial conditions. And I think, if you set this up, you want to think of choosing some initial state. So this gets back to the cosmology. If you're going to apply this to cosmology, how do we describe what happens at the Big Bang? But as far as black holes are concerned, I think, most people are happy just with sort of picking some state about something we want to learn about and evolving into the future. I don't see any time asymmetry, if that's what you're asking, in this description. Joe?
Just to basically say the same thing again. When you look at this picture in space-time, what's more or less happening in the gauge theory is you have some non-equilibrium state initially, which then equilibrates, and you end up with thermal equilibrium. So the white hole would be a situation where you start with a state which looks like it's in thermal, like a thermal state macroscopically, but secretly has correlations, so that when you evolve it forward in time, it turns into a non-thermal state.
Good. So that reinforces the fact that the white hole has to be a very special state, which looks thermal, but it's going to turn into some very special thing.
But you just said that if you evolve in the past, you will get a white hole. And you told us that generally, because of this focusing property, the negative cosmological constant, you will have these things. So I'm confused now, because a few minutes ago I thought that, somehow you needed some meta principle which will tell you. But now when you're saying that one doesn't need a meta principle to select white holes, black holes versus white holes.
It's just the second law of thermodynamics.
But that is something that is added, or is it something that...
No, this
is just it's a law of physics.
This is just an ordinary system, and if you, it evolves toward equilibrium most of the time. So I think what we're saying is, although the space-time picture, looks very similar, in fact, the state, the actual microscopic states associated with white holes have to be very, very special.
But you're saying the generic data... No black hole, no white hole evolves. So take generic data and evolve it to the past, then you're saying you get you generically get white holes. You always get white holes in the past. So that seems at least seems morally to. To say that they're not highly special initial data sets in the past, if generic initial data sets now evolve to them.
I think the situation is very similar to sort of a gas in a box, and you say, take your initial conditions and you let it evolve in the future, and typically, it sort of equilibrates or becomes, partially uniform. Any initial data could be evolved into the past, and you get something. And what we're saying is that something, whatever you get when you evolve that into the past, would be the sort of state corresponding to these white holes.
Well, I think past white holes, unless there's something special in the theory, past white holes are not peculiar. They're ordinary. When you evolve them into the future, they turn black. They're unstable, they turn black, and you get large black holes in the future and entropy increases.
Well, they have to be special if entropy is going to increase, right? You don't lose energy, so if you're saying that entropy increases in this process, then your initial white holes are pretty special. They're not.
Well, I think what you... Okay, so then there's a question of how you define entropy of white holes. So if you take a black hole and try and reverse it, is the is the entropy of the time-reversed configuration the geometrical entropy of the black hole? So normally you would say it's not, because you have access to the stuff that's in the white hole that comes out. And so if you're saying, so when you time reverse, when you time reverse the geometry, I don't think you're entitled to say that the entropy is the same as the entropy that you have of the initial geometry. So I think the counting of entropy is, there's no reason to think the counting of entropy is really invariant under time reversal. There's this paper by Daniel Sudarsky and Raphael Sorkin talking about defining entropy, having to define entropy in a global way. And I think that's that this lack of time reversibility of the entropy is a symptom.
Since you've asked me. Jim, were you waiting?
I was just going back and changing the subject slightly. So you explained to us so nicely that how this near horizon geometry comes up, and there was this question in the beginning as to why is one getting such good answers for the entropy, and then but there's some gap in my understanding here, so I'm just asking. So are you saying that what matters for all these entropy calculations is only the near horizon geometry? And if so, from the point of view of which point of view? From the point of view of presumably from string theory, or from the point of view of gauge theories? And why is it that that's the only thing that matters?
Well, certainly from the gravity side, the entropy we take as 1/4 the area of the horizon. So all you need is the horizon, and you can compute the entropy from that. And the sort of line of arguments here was that region right near the horizon is completely described by this gauge theory or the field theory. And so that's why we...
And also just outside. You're not worrying about inside at all. I mean, all the geometries you're talking about, what matters is really the geometry just outside the horizon. Is that
right? No, that's not true.
Okay.
So maybe I should draw a quick picture over here. So if you just take an extreme Reisner-Nordström, that's the usual Penrose diagram for extreme. And what we're doing is, in a sense, taking a surface which does this. Oh, well. So we're looking at this. It keeps going, of course. But so this is the part outside the horizon. But we're also going inside the horizon a bit, and sort of basically blowing up this region, because that's what gives you the ADS causal diagram looks like this. These time-like wedges are, if you want, these sort of boundaries. And the original horizon corresponds to a null surface in ADS, which looks like that. So this would be the original region outside the horizon, but we're certainly including the region behind the horizon at least a little bit in this near horizon limit.
Can you say again why is it that? Because the near horizon geometry is that of BTZ black hole, and therefore there are no stringy corrections. Can you just amplify on that?
Okay. I should say this is an argument which I think was given by Arkady Seitlin, Steve Gupser, and maybe Klebanov. So the idea was that you have a space of constant curvature. Actually, you're looking at ADS3 cross S3. That is conformally flat, has no Weyl tensor. You look at the structure of the higher order sort of string corrections, and there's an argument that they, either just involve the Weyl tensor, which is zero for this, or they vanish for constant curvature. I'm not really sure what the details are. But I would say that's not on the sort of level of a rigorous proof, but it's more like you can see why the leading terms vanish, and you can sort of roughly, you know, from the space-time picture why this might work.
So it sounds like what you're saying is on the gravity side, you can go from strong coupling to weak coupling, and that the stringy corrections that might have cropped up don't. That's the general.
That's the gist of it.
What about on the conformal field theory side? I mean, why,
well,
once you've given up
shape.
Supersymmetry, why do you still have, what is the relevance of this near horizon geometry to the conformal field theory and the fact that without supersymmetry you still have the exact count of states?
Right. Well, then I would say we're in actually much better shape, because on the, in this case where the entropy agrees exactly, we have just a 1 plus 1 dimensional field theory. And in that case, you can show that the sort of density of states depends on only one parameter of this so-called central charge. And that central charge can be computed exactly for the supersymmetric, superconformal field theories. It can be computed in a way which is independent of the string coupling.
And even when the state itself is not a supersymmetric configuration.
Right.
Is that right?
Right. It's a property of the theory.
Okay.
Yeah.
Simon, any questions?
There has to be a better way. I was just going to amplify on Gary's earlier remark about the near horizon geometries to say that if you're taking the near horizon geometry of, say, one of these near extreme three brains, then what we call the near horizon geometry actually includes the whole interior of the black hole, including this, what is in the classical geometry the singularity.
The near extremal three brains.
Yeah. What's going to be a black hole when I take
right.
the near horizon limit?
Should I say a few words about that? And people are sort of looking a little puzzled.
yeah.
So what Simon is saying, can people see this?
Jim's going to raise this screen.
Oh. I guess. Yeah. So if you look at the structure of one of these near-extremal black three-brain metrics, actually just the one that's up here, this is the metric with P equals 3, I said that Penrose diagrams look like Schwarzschild. And so indeed, you get this sort of structure, except that infinity is now time-like and not space-like. So that's the causal structure. I did that too fast. These space-times are, of course, asymptotically flat. Right, as r goes to infinity, h and f both go to 1, so we have just flat space. These are the original solutions we started with. So we have an asymptotically flat region, so now they really do look like Schwarzschild. And now when you take this near horizon limit, you sort of cut things off near the horizon, which is some sort of time-like surface here. But what Simon is saying is that in the limit, the sort of phi spheres, these sort of transverse phi spheres, actually don't change their radius in this region from the horizon down to the singularity. They stay, approximately constant. Let's see, can we see that from here? Yeah, because that's this 1 over r squared factor from f canceling this thing. And so it is the radius of the phi spheres become essentially constant in here. So the near horizon limit, if you go through it exactly, is just what I wrote there. And you have the inside region, including the singularity there.
Ready? Jim's been waiting for quite a while. Let me run it to him.
When one hears about generalized black holes like this, one's tempted to think about, say, dropping particles in them, and maybe that would be related to your quasi-norm. Is that the wrong thing to think about with these?
No.
So has that been discussed very much?
Yeah, in fact, that's very much what these quasi-normal frequencies was sort of intended to. When I said kick the black hole, I didn't literally mean, you know, use I meant, you know, drop a particle in. So that's exactly the sort of thing you imagine doing. And so, you know, we can discuss how you describe, you know, a particle falling into the space-time is described by something in the gauge theory, which disturbs your initial state. And then the question is, how does this evolve at late times?
And what about black hole collisions or something like that?
Anything you can ask in, you know, the context of the space-time, which is asymptotically ADS, should be describable in the gauge theory. That's what the conjecture says. And so no, we don't have any help for the LIGO people and the people discussing black hole collisions by doing gauge theory calculations. But, you know, in principle, that should be possible.
Yeah, so just to follow up a little bit on the answer that you and Joe gave, I mean, of black holes and presumably white holes corresponding to thermal equilibrium states. And, of course, the small black holes are a sort of funny thermal equilibrium state because they're unstable. They have negative heat capacities, and that's involved in the evaporation. So are you suggesting, I mean, with the Maldacena conjecture, that there is some phase of, or whatever, of the, let me not put too many words in your mouth, of the SUN gauge theory, whereby there are thermal equilibrium states with negative heat capacity?
No.
So then how do you correspond the black holes to thermal equilibrium states?
What I certainly meant, and I think what Joe was referring to, was the case of the large black holes.
Yeah, well, the small ones that are of interest for the evaporation.
Okay, so for the case of small ones, I would not say that a small black hole is described in the gauge theory by a thermal state. I don't know exactly how they're described, but they... I think the sort of stationary thermal states should be an appropriate description for the very large and high energy states, but not for the small black holes. And that, of course, gets into the whole process of how you extend this to the asymptotic flat context, because if we had a good way of describing small black holes, you know, in the ADS case, then you could probably just take over that sector of the gauge theory and use it as your description in flat space. So I don't know what it is.
But it's binary reason. Basically, that, I mean, if it were a canonical ensemble, then the specific, it had to be positive. But on the other hand, when we know that the specific is negative for the small black holes. So that also goes for the Schwarzschild black holes and away from extremality, where the specific heat is actually negative. One cannot hope to describe them in gauge theory in terms of any thermal states. And
right.
So one doesn't have any idea as to what the proper substitute is so far. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, in terms of a microcanonical ensemble, you can certainly argue that for a given energy, the small black holes, if they're not too small, still dominate, you know, the entropy over other configurations. So in that sense, if you're looking at the gauge theory of states of certain energy, a typical state will be a state describing a small black hole, because those are sort of most states. But I don't know how to make any sort of thermal statements about canonical ensembles for that.
To return to the issue of cosmic censorship in five dimensions, in four dimensions, we have the idea if you start with regular initial data, then you don't evolve naked singularities. Is there some sense in which, for example, if you start with compactified circles whose radius is less than the critical amount, that no perturbation could possibly evolve you to one which is greater than the one which would lead to instabilities and violations of cosmic censorship?
Well, the critical radius for the circle depends on the size of your black hole. So I don't know how to make a statement. So you're asking, could there be a form of cosmic censorship in five-dimensional general relativity for space-time, say, with one direction compactified, which said that if you start with a circle small enough, then, you know, everything is fine. Unless that size is, you know, on the order of the Planck scale or the string scale where we expect the sort of theory to... the low energy description to break down, I don't see how you can say that, because if the black hole is, you know, if the size is a millimeter, you know, you just make a black hole which is, you know, a micron across or something, and crosses this, and it would be unstable. So,
is it on that topic?
Yeah, I was just going to ask Gary if you could just respond to my previous comment where I got cut off.
Oh.
Why don't you restate?
Yeah, restate.
Okay.
Your comment, I don't remember.
So what I was saying earlier was that I would expect that if you had a cylinder of dust, let's take the compactified case for simplicity, and you try to collapse it to form one of these flat, unstable black holes, it will experience the same instability as the dust collapses, and it will develop a wiggle. And the serious question for cosmic censorship is whether you can actually form a line-like singularity in the middle of this thing. And as the dust collapses to smaller and smaller radii, this instability will be more and more important for its dynamics. So it seems to me unlikely that any of the dust is going to collapse onto the axis in the region that's going to be in between the black holes at the end of the day.
Well, that's a good point. So I guess you're raising the possibility that if I try to construct this from actual matter, regular initial data, I won't actually produce a naked singularity because things will just break up into independent five-dimensional black holes before it forms anything like a black string. And I guess that's certainly quite a possibility. Yeah, that might be true.
I mean, wouldn't you think that you could choose initial data where, let's say, vacuum, where you already have this black string?
Yeah, right. So that's the context I was originally thinking of. You start with something which is initial data for this black string wrapped up into a huge circle, and then you perturb it a little bit. But if you try to do it from, you know, completely, you know, data on R4 or something.
Actually, I had a question about that, maybe for the audience in general, but it seems like that would be something that would be amenable to numerical analysis. It's like a axisymmetric problem. There are only three relevant dimensions, and people in this room are already doing this kind of problem. So
very good point.
Why not just evolve such data?
I think it's relevant here. So one can look at the analogous collapse in four dimensions of a torus of dust or a cylinder of dust, and certainly if you set it up so that the dust has initial velocity symmetrically pointing inward, then you get a naked singularity from collapse of a cylinder, and I presume from collapse of a large torus.
Right.
And the relevant theorem here by Alan Rendell says if instead of starting with dust, you start with collisionless matter, in which the distribution function in phase space is not a shell, but is as smooth as it is when all the velocities point inward, and are the same. So you've got, in effect, a singular distribution function in phase space leading to this singularity. If instead of that you just have a smooth distribution function in phase space, then collisionless matter has non-singular evolution.
Yeah, the same question, just to follow up what I was saying, interrupting you during your talk. I guess the key point is, how do you know this black string that you've wrapped around is not already inside some spherical horizon? In other words, there's a mass per unit length, roughly speaking, that you have for the black string, and times the length will give you a mass, and basically divided by the same length will give you, so the mass per unit length will be some number that would need to be compared with an effective Schwarzschild radius per mass, and if they're of the same order of magnitude, then the chances are the whole thing is already actually inside some spherical topology horizon to begin with, even though you, I mean,
but I can adjust the mass per unit length by essentially taking the Schwarzschild radius of the four-dimensional black hole to be as small as I want. So that's the idea. You take I think there's no doubt that you have these configurations because you have the black strings initially, which is a Schwarzschild black hole cross R, and if I just wrap that R into a very long circle, I don't think the total mass.
Yeah. So if the mass per unit length is freely adjustable, then you should be able to do that.
I actually just wanted to ask a question to the audience based on Bob's earlier comment about topological censorship, which is, do any experts who happen to be here think that topological censorship is straightforward in 4 plus 1 dimensions, or is that trickier than 3 plus 1 for some reason?
Well,
right.
A topological censorship in its standard forms holds in any dimension.
But actually, that doesn't imply that there can't be initial data with on some slice on which the horizon is toroidal.
Don't the theorems that black holes have spherical horizons, right? I mean, as a la Hawking. I mean, in the final computation, you have to use the Gauss-Bonnet theorem on two dimensions, and I don't know what happens.
That's Hawking's original argument, that is not the topological censorship is a tool for studying black hole topology. It's not used Gauss-Bonnet.
Okay.
Just a minute, Daniel is talking.
I have a question. I understood that you concluded that this instability of these strings, you concluded that it exists because you compare the area of the black hole configuration for the two.
It was one of the arguments that Gregory and Laplanche gave to support the
because,
instability.
Well, my point is that the area increase theorem is related to cosmic censorship. So once you are going to start questioning the cosmic censorship, I wonder how you can use arguments based on area increase theorem to conclude instabilities.
Well, I think it was more like just looking at these two configurations. One of them had more entropy than the other, so it was not implausible that it was sort of evolved.
But also you mentioned, I mean, the more explicit argument is that there are perturbations that are unstable.
Right. So that's the real calculation for the instability. That the actual linearized analysis gives you exponentially growing modes.
Can I come back to Abhay's question, where are the brains? You answered it in the easy case of extremal black holes.
Right.
What would your comment be for a non-extremal black hole or black brain?
Well, this has been much debated. In the near horizon limit, I would say the consensus is that sort of the brains are everywhere. That you have, it is the brains, it's this sort of N, the charge of the brain, which is giving rise to this effective cosmological constant. And to the extent that you're looking at space-times, which solve Einstein's equation with this, you know, effective cosmological constant coming from the charge everywhere, then I don't think it makes sense to say the brains really live at one surface in this ADS space. I think the better description is the fact that the dynamics of the brains is given by the gauge theory. And what we're saying is that the gauge theory is describing physics everywhere. So, at least in that case.
Well, then I must ask a question of something that's been asked to me. How do you guys know that when you turn the coupling up, the deep brain configuration becomes a black hole rather than, let's call it, a string star? I mean, if the brains are everywhere, am I supposed to visualize that as puffed up brains that are filling regions of space, and therefore maybe the configuration really is just a string star?
No. In the asymptotically flat context, nobody says the brains, you know, fill up all space and goes out to infinity. So the brains are clearly localized.
Well, I don't mean infinity. I mean just goes out to one string length beyond the horizon, let's say.
In these near extremal cases, I mean, in a sense, having the brains everywhere in the near horizon geometry means that in some sense they are filling this whole region inside the black hole and right near the horizon.
So.
You can argue similar.
That's a good way to quiet her.
I think we know that these are not going to be stars. I mean, we can just look at the mass, we can look at the gravitational coupling, compute the Schwarzschild radius, and the key, you know, that you form the black holes when the Schwarzschild radius is,
you know. In some sense, asking in the supergravity, where is the brain, is not really a that well-defined question. I mean, you know, if we look at it in the gauge theory language, we can say something about where is the brain. But in the supergravity side, it's a much more fuzzy kind of question. I mean, what you've got on the supergravity side is a supergravity solution.
I was just going to add one more comment to the last thing that Amanda said there, which is from the supergravity perspective, I think it's actually clear that the brains are just not there in these ADS cases, right? The ADS thing is a solution of pure supergravity with no external sources added. The brains or the field theory is some other description of the same physics. It doesn't really belong in the same picture as the ADS space.
Well, I guess, unfortunately, we are out of time. I'm very pleased to see how this discussion period kicked off the conference. I hope and expect the rest of them will be so interesting, and we'll have to take up the rest of the questions privately. Thank you very much, Gary.